Tenedra sprang out of her saddle and ran toward the beautiful tree, her deep red hair flying behind her.
"It's beautiful,"
she exclaimed, placing her hands with reverent affection on the rough bark. Mr. Wolf shook his head. Dryads. They grow giddy at the sight of trees.
I don't recognize it, Durnick said with a slight frown. It's not an oak.
Maybe it's some southern species, Barak suggested. I've never seen one exactly like it myself.
Oh, he's very old,
Tenedra said, putting her cheek fondly against the tree trunk.
And he speaks strangely, but he likes me.
What kind of tree is he?
Durnick asked. He was still frowning, his need to classify and categorize frustrated by this huge tree.
It's the only one of its kind in the world, Mr. Wolf told him. I don't think we ever named it. It was always just the tree. We used to meet here sometimes.
It doesn't seem to drop any berries or fruit or seeds of any kind, Durnick observed, examining the ground beneath the spreading branches.
It doesn't need them, Wolf replied. As I told you, it's the only one of its kind. It's always been here. Always will be. It feels no urge to propagate itself.
Durnick seemed worried about it.
I've never heard of a tree with no seeds.
It's a rather special tree, Durnick, Aunt Paul said. It sprouted on the day the world was made. And it will probably stand here for as long as the world exists. It has a purpose other than reproducing itself.
Now what purpose is that?
We don't know, Wolf answered. We only know that it's the oldest living thing in the world.
Maybe that's its purpose. Maybe it's here to demonstrate the continuity of life.
Tenedra had removed her shoes and was climbing up into the thick branches, making little sounds of affection and delight.
Is there by any chance a tradition of linking dryads with squirrels?
Silk asked.
Mr. Wolf smiled. If the rest of you can manage without us, Geryon and I have something to attend to.
Aunt Paul looked at him questioningly.
It is time for a little instruction, Paul.
We can manage, Father. Will you be back in time for supper?
Keep it warm for us. Coming, Geryon?
The two of them rode in silence through the green meadows, with the golden afternoon sunlight making the entire vale warm and lovely. Geryon was baffled by Mr. Wolf's curious change of mood. Always before, there had been sort of an impromptu quality about the old man. He seemed frequently to be making up his life as he went along, relying on chance, his wits, and his power, when necessary, to see him through. Here in the vale, he seemed serene, undisturbed by the chaotic events taking place in the world outside. About 2 miles from the tree stood another tower. It was rather squat and round, and was built of rough stone. Arched windows near the top faced out in the directions of the four winds, but there seemed to be no door.
"You said you'd like to visit my tower?" Wolf said, dismounting. "This is it."
"It isn't ruined like the others."
"I take care of it from time to time. Shall we go up?"
Geryon slid down from his horse.
"Where's the door?"
"Right there."
Wolf pointed at a large stone in the rounded wall. Geryon looked skeptical. Mr. Wolf stepped in front of the stone.
"It's me," he said. "Open."
The surge Geryon felt at the old man's word seemed commonplace, ordinary. A household kind of surge that spoke of something that had been done so often that it was no longer a wonder. The rock turned obediently, revealing a sort of narrow, irregular doorway. Motioning for Geryon to follow, Wolf squeezed through into the dim chamber beyond the door. The tower, Geryon saw, was not a hollow shell as he had expected, but rather was a solid pedestal, pierced only by a stairway winding upward.
"Come along,"
Wolf told him, starting up the worn stone steps.
"You watch that one,"
he said about halfway up, pointing at one of the steps. The stone is loose.
Well, then why don't you fix it?
Geryon asked, stepping up over the loose stone.
Oh, I've been meaning to, but I just haven't gotten around to it. It's been that way for a long time. I'm so used to it now that I never seem to think of fixing it when I'm here.
The chamber at the top of the tower was round and very cluttered. A thick coat of dust lay over everything. There were several tables in various parts of the room covered with rolls and scraps of parchment, strange-looking implements and models, bits and pieces of rock and glass, and a couple of birds' nests. On one, a curious stick was so wound and twisted and coiled that Geryon's eye could not exactly follow its convolutions. He picked it up and turned it over in his hands, trying to trace it out.
What is this, Grandfather?
That? Oh, it's one of Pulgrim's toys, the old man said absently, staring around at the dusty chamber.
What's it supposed to do?
Keep her quiet, when she was a baby, that is. She only got one end. She spent 5 years trying to figure it out.
Geryon pulled his eyes off of the fascinating, compelling piece of wood.
Well, that's a cruel sort of thing to do to a child.
Well, I had to do something, Wolf answered. She had a penetrating voice as a child. Beldoran was a quiet, happy little girl, but your aunt never seemed satisfied.
Beldoran?
Your aunt's twin sister.
The old man's voice trailed off, and he looked sadly out of one of the windows for a few moments. Finally, he sighed and turned back to the round room.
I suppose I ought to clean this up a bit.
He looked again around at the dust and litter.
Let me help, Geryon offered.
Just be careful not to break anything, the old man warned. Some of those things took me centuries to make.
He began moving around the chamber, picking things up and setting them down again, blowing now and then on them to clear away a bit of the dust. His efforts didn't really seem to be getting anywhere. Finally, he stopped, staring at a low, rough-looking chair with the rail along its back scarred and gashed, as if it had been continually grasped by strong claws. He sighed again.
What's wrong?
Poledra's chair, Wolf said. My wife. She used to perch there and watch me, sometimes for years on end.
Perch?
She was fond of the shape of the owl.
Oh.
Geryon had somehow never thought of the old man as ever having been married, although he obviously had to have been at some time since Aunt Paul and her twin sister were his daughters. The shadowy wife's affinity for owls, however, explained Aunt Paul's own preference for the shape. The two women, Poledra and Beldoran, were involved rather intimately in his own background, he realized, but quite irrationally he resented them. They had shared a part of the lives of his aunt and his grandfather that he would never, could never know. The old man moved a parchment and picked up a peculiar-looking device with a sighting glass in one end of it.
"I thought I'd lost you,"
he told the device, touching it with a familiar fondness.
"You have been under that parchment all this time."
"What is it?"
"Yeah, a thing I made when I was trying to discover the reason for mountains."
"The reason?"
"Yes, everything has a reason."
Wolf raised the instrument.
"You see, what you do is..."
He broke off and laid the device back on the table.
It's much too complicated to explain. I'm not even sure if I remember exactly how to use it myself. I haven't touched it since before Belzedar came to the Vale. When he arrived, I had to lay my studies aside to train him."
He looked around at the dust and clutter.
This is useless. The dust will just come back anyway.
Were you alone here before Belzedar came?
My master was here. That's his tower over there.
Wolf pointed through the north window at a tall, slender stone structure about a mile away.
Was he really here? I mean, not just his spirit?
No, he was really here. That was before the gods departed.
Did you live here always?
No. I came like a thief, looking for something to steal. Well, that's not actually true, I suppose. I was about your age when I came here. I was dying at the time.
Dying?
Freezing to death. I had left the village I was born in the year before, after my mother died, and spent my first winter in the camp of the Godless Ones. They were very old by then.
Godless Ones?
Ulgos. Or rather the ones who decided not to follow Gorum to Prolgu. They stopped having children after that, so they were happy to take me in. I couldn't understand their language at the time, and all their pampering got on my nerves, so I ran away in the spring. I was on my way back the next fall, but I got caught in an early snowstorm, not far from here. I lay down against the side of my master's tower to die. I did not know it was a tower at first, with all that snow swirling around. It just looked like a pile of rock. As I recall, I was feeling rather sorry for myself at the time.
Well, I can imagine. Geryon shivered at the thought of being alone and dying.
Oh, I was a sniveling bit. Sound disturbed my master. He let me in, probably more to quiet me than for any other reason. As soon as I got inside, I started looking for things to steal.
But he made you a sorcerer instead?
No. He made me a servant. A slave. I worked for him for 5 years, before I even found out who he was. Oh, sometimes I think I hated him. But I had to do what he told me to. I didn't really know why. The last straw came when he told me to move a big rock out of his way. I tried with all my strength, but I couldn't budge it. Finally, I got angry enough to move it with my mind instead of my back. That's what he had been waiting for, of course. After that, we got along better. He changed my name from Gareth to Belgareth, and he made me his pupil.
And his disciple?
That took a little longer. I had a lot to learn. I was examining the reason that certain stars fell at the time he first called me his disciple, and he was working on a round gray stone he had picked up by the riverbank.
Did you ever discover the reason? That stars fall, I mean?
Yes. It's not all that complicated. It has to do with balance. The world needs a certain weight to keep it turning. When it starts to slow down, a few nearby stars fall. Their weight makes up the difference.
I never thought of that.
Neither did I. Not for quite some time.
The stone you mentioned, was it...
The orb. Just an ordinary rock until my master touched it. Anyway, I learned the secret of the will and the word, which isn't really that much of a secret after all. It's there, in all of us. Or did I say that before?
I think so.
Probably so. I tend to repeat myself.
The old man picked up a roll of parchment and glanced at it, then lay it aside again.
Oh, so much that I've started and haven't finished.
Grandfather?
Yes, Geryon.
This thing of ours, how much can you actually do with it?
That depends on your mind, Geryon. The complexity of it lies in the complexity of the mind that puts it to use. Quite obviously, it can't do something that can't be imagined by the mind that focuses it. That was the purpose of our studies, to expand our minds, so that we could use the power more fully.
Everybody's mind is different, though.
Geryon was struggling toward an idea.
Yes?
Wouldn't that mean that... this thing?
He shied away from the word power.
Well, what I mean is it different? Sometimes you do things, and other times you have Aunt Paul do them.
Wolf nodded.
It is different, in each one of us. There are certain things we can all do, We can all move things, for example.
Aunt Paul called it trans...
Geryon hesitated, not remembering the word.
Translocation, Wolf supplied. Moving something from one place to another. It is the simplest thing you can do. Usually the thing you do first. And it makes the most noise.
That's what she told me.
Geryon remembered the slave he had jerked from the river at Stithis Tor, the slave who had died.
Palgara can do things that I cannot,
Wolf continued.
Not because she's any stronger than I am, but because she thinks differently than I do. We're not sure how much you can do yet, because we don't know exactly how your mind works. You seem to be able to do certain things quite easily, that I would not even attempt. Maybe it's because you don't realize how difficult they are.
I don't quite understand what you mean.
The old man looked at him.
Perhaps you don't at that. Remember the crazy monk who tried to attack you in that village in northern Tolnedra, just after we left Orindia?
Geryon nodded.
You cured his madness. It doesn't sound like much until you realize that in the instant you cured him, you had to understand fully the nature of his insanity. That's an extremely difficult thing, and you did it without even thinking about it. And then, of course, there was the colt.
Geryon glanced down through the window at the little horse friskily running through the field surrounding the tower.
The colt was dead, but you made him start to breathe. In order for you to do that, you had to be able to understand death.
It was just a wall. All I did was reach through it.
There's more to it than that, I think. What you seem to be able to do is to visualize extremely difficult ideas in very simple terms. That's a rare gift. But there are some dangers involved in it that you should be aware of.
Dangers? Such as what?
Don't oversimplify. If a man is dead, for example, he is usually dead for a very good reason, like a sword through the heart. If you bring him back, he will only die immediately again anyway. As I said before, just because you can do something does not necessarily mean that you should.
Geryon sighed.
I'm afraid this is going to take a very long time, Grandfather. I have to learn how to keep myself under control. I have to learn what I can't do, so I don't kill myself trying to do something that's impossible. I have to learn what I can do and what I should do. I wish this had never happened to me.
We all do, sometimes. The decision was not ours to make, though. I have not always liked some of the things I've had to do. Neither has your aunt. However, what we are doing is more important than we are, so we do what is expected of us, like it or not.
What if I just said, no, I won't do it?
You could do that, I suppose. But you won't, will you?
Geryon sighed again.
No. I guess not.
The old sorcerer put his arm around the boy's shoulders.
I thought you might see things that way, Belgerian. You're bound to this the same way we all are.
The strange thrill he always felt at the sound of his other secret name ran through Geryon.
Why do you all insist on calling me that?
Belgerian, Wolf said mildly. Think, boy. Think what it means. I haven't been talking to you and telling you stories all of these years just because I like the sound of my own voice.
Geryon turned it over carefully in his mind.
You were Gerath, he mused thoughtfully. But the god Aldur changed your name to Belgerath. Zadar was Zadar first and then Belzadar. And then he went back to being Zadar again.
And in my old tribe... Polgara would have just been Gara. Paul is like Bel. The only difference is that she's a woman. Her name comes from mine because she's my daughter. Your name comes from mine, too.
Geryon? Gareth,
the boy said.
Belgarath. Bulgarian.
It all fits together, doesn't it?
Naturally, the old man replied. I'm glad you noticed it.
Garion grinned at him, and then a thought occurred.
But I'm not really Belgarian yet, am I?
Not entirely. You still have a way to go.
I suppose I had better get started, then,
Garion said with a certain ruefulness,
since I don't really have any choice.
Somehow I knew that eventually you'd come around,
Mr. Wolf said.
Don't you sometimes wish that I was just Garion again, and you were that old storyteller coming to visit Faldor's farm, with Aunt Paul making supper in the kitchen as she did in the old days, and we were hiding under a haystack with a bottle I'd stolen for you?
Garion felt homesickness welling up in him.
Yes. Sometimes, Garion. Sometimes,
Wolf admitted, his eyes far away.
We won't ever be able to go back there again, will we?
Not the same way, no.
I'll be Belgarion and you'll be Belgarath. We won't even be the same people anymore.
Everything changes, Garion.
Show me the rock,
Garion said suddenly.
Which rock?
The one Aldo made you move, the day you first discovered the power.
Oh, that rock. It's right over there, the white one. The one the colt is sharpening his hooves on.
It's a very big rock.
I'm glad you appreciate that, Belgarath replied modestly. I thought so myself.
Do you suppose that I could move it?
You never know until you try, Garion, Belgarath told him.
Chapter 11 The next morning, when Garion awoke, he knew immediately that he was not alone.
Where have you been?
He asked silently.
I've been watching,
the other consciousness in his mind said. I see that you have finally come around.
What choice did I have?
None. You'd better get up. Aldur's coming. Garion quickly rolled out of his blankets.
Here? Are you sure?
The voice in his mind did not answer. Garion put on a clean tunic and hose and wiped off his half-boots with a certain amount of care. Then he went out of the tent he shared with Silk and Durnik. The sun was just coming up over the high mountains to the east, and the line between sunlight and shadow moved with a stately ponderousness across the dewy grass of the vale. Aunt Paul and Belgarath stood near the small fire, where a pot was just beginning to bubble. They were talking quietly, and Garion joined them.
You are up early,
Aunt Paul said. She reached out and smoothed his hair.
I was awake,
he replied. He looked around, wondering from which direction Aldor would come.
Your grandfather tells me that the two of you had a very long talk yesterday.
Garion nodded.
I understand a few things a little better now. I'm sorry I've been so difficult.
She drew him to her and put her arms around him.
It's all right, dear. You had some hard decisions to make. You are not angry with me, then? Oh, of course not, dear.
The others had begun to get up, coming out of their tents, yawning and stretching and rumpled-looking.
What do we do today?
Silk asked, coming to the fire and rubbing the sleep from his eyes.
We wait, Belgarath told him. My master said he would meet us here.
I'm curious to see him. I've never met a god before.
The curiosity, methinks, will soon be satisfied, Prince Skeldar. Look there, Mandarallan said, pointing.
Coming across the meadow, not far from the great tree beneath which they had pitched their tents, a figure in a blue robe was approaching. A soft nimbus of blue light surrounded the figure, and the immediate sense of presence made it instantly clear that what approached was not a man. Garion was not prepared for the impact of that presence. His meeting with the spirit of Issa in Queen Salmisra's throne room had been clouded by the narcotic effects of the things the Serpent Queen had forced him to drink. Similarly, Half of his mind had slept during the confrontation with Mara and the ruins of Mar Amon. But now, fully awake in the first light of morning, he found himself in the presence of a god. Aldor's face was kindly and enormously wise. His long hair and beard were white, from conscious choice. Geryon felt rather than from any result of age. The face was very familiar to him somehow. It bore a startling resemblance to Belgarath's, but Geryon perceived immediately with a sudden curious inversion of his original notion that it was Belgarath who resembled Aldur. As if their centuries of association had stamped Aldur's features upon the face of the old man. There were differences, of course. That certain mischievous roguishness was not present on the calm face of Aldur. That quality was Belgarath's own, the last remnant, perhaps, of the face of the thieving boy Aldur had taken into his tower on a snowy day some 7,000 years ago.
"Master," Belgarath said, bowing respectfully, as Aldur approached.
"Belgarath," the god acknowledged.
His voice was very quiet.
"I have not seen thee in some time. The years have not been unkind to thee."
Belgarath shrugged wryly.
"Some days I feel them more than others, master. I carry a great number of years with me."
Aldur smiled and turned to Aunt Paul.
"My beloved daughter,"
he said fondly, reaching out to touch the white lock at her brow.
"Thou art as lovely as ever."
"And thou as kind, master," she replied, smiling and inclining her head.
There passed among the three of them a kind of intensely personal linkage, a joining of minds that marked their reunion. Geryon could feel the edges of it with his own mind, and he was somewhat wistful at being excluded, though he realized at once there was no intent to exclude him. They were merely re-establishing an eons-old companionship, shared experiences that stretched back into antiquity. Aldur then turned to look at the others.
"And so, you have come together at last, as it has been foretold from the beginning of days that you should. You are the instruments of destiny, and my blessing goes with each as you move toward that awful day when the universe will become one again."
The faces of Geryon's companions were awed and puzzled by Aldur's enigmatic blessing. Each, however, bowed with profound respect and humility. And then Tenedra emerged from the tent she shared with Aunt Paul. The tiny girl stretched luxuriantly and ran her fingers through the tumbled mass of her flaming hair. She was dressed in a dryad tunic and sandals.
"Tenedra?" Aunt Paul called her. "Come here."
"Yes, Lady Polgara,"
the little princess replied obediently. She crossed to the fire, her feet seeming barely to touch the ground. Then she saw Aldur standing with the others and stopped, her eyes wide.
"This is our master, Tenedra. He wanted to meet you."
The princess stared at the glowing presence in confusion. Nothing in her life had prepared her for such a meeting. She lowered her eyelashes and then looked up shyly, her tiny face artfully and automatically assuming its most appealing expression. Aldur smiled gently.
"She's like a flower that charms without knowing it."
His eyes looked deeply into those of the princess.
"There is steel in this one, however. She is fit for her task. My blessings upon thee, my child."
Tenedra responded with an instinctively graceful curtsy. It was the first time Geryon had ever seen her bow to anyone. Aldur turned then to look full at Geryon. A brief, unspoken acknowledgment passed between the god and the consciousness that shared Geryon's thoughts. There was in that momentary meeting a sense of mutual respect and of shared responsibility. And then, Geryon felt the massive touch of Aldur's mind upon his own, and knew that the god had instantly seen and understood his every thought and feeling.
"Hail, Belgarion," Aldor said gravely.
"Master,"
Garion replied. He dropped to one knee, not really knowing why.
"We have awaited thy coming since time's beginning. Thou art the vessel of all our hopes."
Aldor raised his hand.
"My blessing, Belgarion. I am well pleased with thee."
Garion's entire being was suffused with love and gratitude as the warmth of Aldor's benediction filled him.
"Dear Polgara," Aldor said to Aunt Paul, "thy gift to us is beyond value. Belgarion has come at last, and the world trembles at his coming."
Aunt Paul bowed again.
"Let us now go apart," Aldor said to Belgarath and Aunt Paul. "Your task is well begun, and I must now provide you with that instruction I promised when first I set your steps upon this path. That which once clouded becomes clearer, and we now can see what lies before us. Let us look toward that day that we have all awaited, and make our preparations."
The three of them moved away from the fire, and it seemed to Garion that as they went, the glowing nimbus which had surrounded Aldor now enclosed Aunt Paul and his grandfather as well. Some movement or sound distracted his eye for a moment, and when he looked back, the three of them had vanished.
Morak let out his breath explosively. "Belor, but that was something to see."
"We have been favored, I think, beyond all men," Mandarallan said.
They all stood staring at each other, caught up in the wonder of what they had just witnessed. Tenedra, however, broke the mood.
"All right,"
she ordered peremptorily.
"Don't just stand there gaping. Move away from the fire."
"What are you going to do?"
"The Lady Polgara is going to be busy,"
the little girl said loftily.
"So I am going to make the breakfast."
She moved toward the fire with a businesslike bustling. The bacon was not too badly burned, but Senedra's attempt to toast slices of bread before the open fire turned out disastrously. And her porridge had lumps in it as solid as clods in a sun-baked field. Garion and the others, however, ate what she offered without comment, prudently avoiding the direct gaze she leveled at them, as if daring them to speak so much as one word of criticism.
"I wonder how long that they are going to be," Silk said after breakfast.
"Gods, I think, have little notion of time," Barak replied sagely, stroking at his beard. "I don't expect them back until sometime this afternoon at the earliest."
"It is a good time to check over the horses,"
Hetar decided.
"Some of them have picked up a few burrs along the way, and I would like to have a look at their hooves, just to be on the safe side."
"I'll help you,"
Dernick offered, getting up. Hetar nodded, and the two of them went off to the place where the horses were picketed.
"And I've got a nick or two in my sword edge,"
Barak remembered, fishing a piece of polishing stone out of his belt and laying his heavy blade across his lap. Mandarallan went to his tent and brought out his armor. He laid it out on the ground and began a minute inspection for dents and spots of rust. Silk rattled a pair of dice hopefully in one hand, looking inquiringly at Barak.
"If it's all the same to you, I think that I would like to enjoy the company of my money for a while longer," the big man told him.
"Oh, this whole place absolutely reeks of domesticity," Silk complained.
Then he sighed, put away his dice, and went to fetch a needle and thread and tunic that he had torn on a bush up in the mountains. Tenedra had returned to her communion with the vast tree, and was scampering among the branches, taking what Garion felt to be an inordinate risk as she jumped from limb to limb with a cat-like unconcern. After watching her for a few moments, he fell into a kind of reverie, thinking back to the awesome meeting that morning. He had met the gods Asa and Mara already. but there was something special about Aldur. The affinity Belgarath and Aunt Paul showed so obviously for this god, who had always remained aloof from men, spoke loudly to Geryon. The devotional activities of Sindaria, where he had been raised, were inclusive rather than exclusive. A good Sindar prayed impartially and honored all of the gods, even Torak. Geryon now, however, felt a special closeness and reverence for Aldur, and the adjustment in his theological thinking required a certain amount of thought. A twig dropped out of the tree onto his head, and he glanced up with annoyance. Zenedra, grinning impishly, was directly over his head.
"Boy,"
she said in her most superior and insulting tone,
"the breakfast dishes are getting cold. The grease is going to be difficult to wash off if you let it harden."
"I'm not your scullion," he told her.
"Wash the dishes, Geryon,"
she ordered him, nibbling at the tip of a lock of hair. "Wash them yourself." She glared down at him, biting rather savagely at the unoffending lock.
"Why do you keep chewing on your hair like that?" "What are you talking about?"
she demanded, removing the lock from between her teeth.
"Every time I look at you, you've got your hair stuck in your mouth." "I do not,"
she retorted indignantly.
"Are you going to wash those dishes?"
"No," he squinted up at her. The short dryad tunic she was wearing seemed to expose an unseemly amount of leg.
"Why don't you go put on some clothes?"
he suggested. "Some of us don't appreciate the way you run around half-naked all of the time." The fight got underway almost immediately after that. Finally, Geryon gave up his efforts to get in the last word and stomped away with disgust.
"Geryon,"
she screamed after him,
"don't you dare go off and leave me with all of these dirty dishes."
He ignored her and kept walking. After a short distance, he felt a familiar nuzzling at his elbow, and he rather absently scratched the colt's ears. The small animal quivered with delight and rubbed against him affectionately. Then, unable to restrain himself any more, the colt galloped off into the meadow to pester a family of docilely feeding rabbits. Geryon found himself smiling. The morning was just too beautiful to allow the squabble with the princess to spoil it. There was, it seemed, something rather special about the Vale. The world around grew cold with the approach of winter, and was buffeted by storms and dangers. But here, it seemed as if the hand of Aldur stretched protectively above them, filling this special place with warmth and peace, and a kind of eternal and magical serenity. Geryon, at this trying point in his life, needed all of the warmth and peace that he could get. There were things that had to be worked out, and he needed a time, however brief, without storms and dangers to deal with them. He was halfway to Belgarath's tower before he realized that it had been there that he had been going all along. The tall grass was wet with dew, and his boots were soon soaked, but even that did not spoil the day. He walked around the tower several times, gazing up at it. Although he found the stone that marked the door quite easily, he decided not to open it. It would not be proper to go uninvited into the old man's tower, and beyond that, he was not entirely certain that the door would respond to any voice but Belgarath's. He stopped quite suddenly at that last thought, and started searching back, trying to find the exact instant when he had ceased to think of his grandfather as Mr. Wolf, and had finally accepted the fact that he was Belgarath. The changeover seemed significant, a kind of turning point. Still lost in thought, he turned then and walked across the meadow toward the large white rock the old man had pointed out to him from the tower window. Absently, he put one hand on it and pushed. The rock did not budge. Geryon set both hands on it and pushed again. Nothing happened. He stepped back and considered it. It wasn't really a vast boulder. It was rounded and white, and not quite as high as his waist. Heavy, certainly, but it should not be so inflexibly solid. He bent over to look at the bottom, and then he understood. The underside of this rock was flat. It would never roll. The only way to move it would be to lift one side and tip it over. He walked around the rock, looking at it from every angle. He judged that it was marginally movable. If he exerted every ounce of his strength, he might be able to lift it. He sat down and looked at it, thinking hard. As he did sometimes, he talked to himself, trying to lay out the problem.
"Well, the first thing to do is to try to move it," he concluded. "Doesn't really look totally impossible. Then, if that doesn't work, we'll try it the other way."
He stood up, stepped purposefully to the rock, wormed his fingers under the edge of it, and heaved. Nothing happened.
"Have to try a little harder," he told himself.
He spread his feet and set himself. He began to lift again, straining, the cords standing out in his neck. For the space of about 10 heartbeats, he tried as hard as he could to lift that stubborn rock, not to roll it over, he had given up on that after the first instant, but simply to make it budge, to acknowledge his existence. Though the ground was not particularly soft there, his feet actually sank as he strained against the rock's weight. Little dots seemed to swirl in front of his eyes as he released the rock and collapsed, gasping against it. He lay against the cold, gritty surface for several minutes, recovering.
"All right. Now we know that that won't work."
He stepped back and sat down. Each time he had done something with his mind before, it had been on impulse, a response to some crisis. He had never sat down and deliberately worked himself up to it. He discovered almost at once that the entire set of circumstances was completely different. The whole world seemed suddenly filled with distractions. Birds sang. A breeze brushed his face. An ant crawled across his hand. Each time he began to bring his will to bear, something pulled his attention away. There was a certain feeling to it. He knew that. A tightness in the back of his head and a sort of pushing out with his forehead. He closed his eyes, and that seemed to help. It was coming. It was slow, but he felt the will beginning to build in him. Remembering something, he reached inside his tunic and put the mark on his palm against the amulet. The force within him, amplified by that touch, built to a great roaring crescendo. He kept his eyes closed and stood up. Then he opened his eyes and looked hard at the stubborn white rock.
"You will move," he muttered.
He kept his right hand on the amulet and held out his left hand, palm up.
"Now,"
he said sharply, and slowly began to raise his left hand in a lifting motion. The force within him surged, and the roaring sound inside his head became deafening. Slowly, the edge of the rock came up out of the grass. Worms and burrowing grubs who had lived their lives in the safe, comfortable darkness under the rock flinched as the morning sunlight hit them. Ponderously, the rock raised, obeying Geryon's inexorable lifting hand. It teetered for a second on its edge, then toppled slowly over. The exhaustion he had felt after trying to lift the rock with his back was nothing compared to the bone-deep weariness that swept over him after he let the clenching of his will relax. He folded his arms on the grass and let his head sink down on them. After a moment or two, that peculiar fact began to dawn on him. He was still standing, but his arms were folded comfortably in front of him on the grass. He jerked his head up and looked around in confusion. He had moved the rock, certainly. That much was obvious, since the rock now lay on its rounded top with its damp underside turned up. Something else had also happened, however. Though he had not touched the rock, its weight had nonetheless been upon him as he had lifted it, and the force he had directed at it had not all gone at the rock. With dismay, Geryon realized that he had sunk up to his armpits in the firm soil of the meadow.
"Oh, well, then now what do I do?"
he asked himself helplessly. He shuddered away from the idea of once again mustering his will to pull himself out of the ground. He was too exhausted even to consider it. He tried to wriggle, thinking that he might be able to loosen the earth around him and work his way up an inch at a time, but he could not so much as budge.
"Look what you've done," he accused the rock.
The rock ignored him.
A thought occurred to him. "Are you in there?"
he asked, that awareness that seemed always to have been with him. The silence in his mind was profound.
"Help!"
he shouted. A bird, attracted by the exposed worms and bugs that had been under the rock, cocked one eye at him and then went back to its breakfast. Geryon heard a light step behind him and craned around, trying to see. The colt was staring at him in amazement. Hesitantly, the small horse thrust out his nose and nuzzled Geryon's face.
"That's a good horse,"
Geryon said, relieved not to be alone, at least. An idea came to him.
"You're going to have to go get Hetar," he told the colt.
The colt pranced about and nuzzled his face again.
"Oh, stop that," Geryon commanded. "This is serious."
Cautiously, he tried to push his mind into the colt's thoughts. He tried a dozen different ways until he finally struck the right combination by sheer accident. The colt's mind flitted from here to there without purpose or pattern. It was a baby's mind, vacant of thought, receiving only sense impressions. Geryon caught flickering images of green grass and running and clouds in the sky and warm milk. He also felt the sense of wonder in that little mind, and the abiding love that the colt had for him. Slowly, painfully, Geryon began constructing a picture of Hetar in the colt's wandering thoughts. It seemed to take forever.
"Hetar,"
Geryon said over and over,
"go get Hetar. Tell him that I'm in trouble."
The colt scampered around and came back to stick his soft nose in Geryon's ear.
"Please pay attention,"
Geryon cried. "Please." Finally, after what seemed hours, the colt seemed to understand. He went several paces away, then came back to nuzzle Geryon again.
"Go get Hetar,"
Geryon ordered, stressing each word. The colt pawed at the ground, then turned and galloped away, going in the wrong direction. Geryon started to swear. For almost a year now, he had been exposed to some of the more colorful parts of Barak's vocabulary. After he had repeated all of the phrases that he remembered 6 or 8 times, he began to extemporize. A flickering thought came back to him from the now-vanished colt. The little beast was chasing butterflies. Geryon pounded the ground with his fists, wanting to howl with frustration. The sun rose higher, and it started to get hot. It was early afternoon when Hetar and Silk, following the prancing little colt, found him.
"How in the world did you manage to do that?" Silk asked curiously.
"I don't want to talk about it,"
Geryon muttered, somewhere between relief and total embarrassment.
"He probably can do many things that we cannot,"
Hetar observed, climbing down from his horse and untying Durnik's shovel from his saddle.
"The thing that I do not understand, though, is why he would want to do that."
"Oh, I'm positive he had a good reason for it," Silk assured him.
"Do you think we should ask him?
It's probably very complicated. I'm sure simple men like you and me would not be able to understand it. Do you suppose that he is finished with whatever it is he is doing?"
"Oh, we could ask him, I suppose."
"I would not want to disturb him. It could be very important."
"Oh, it almost has to be."
"Will you please get me out of here?"
Geryon begged.
"Are you sure that you're quite finished? We can wait, if you're not done yet."
"Please?"
Geryon asked, almost in tears.
Chapter 12.
"Why did you try to lift it?"
Belgarath asked Geryon the next morning, after he and Aunt Paul had returned, and Silk and Hettar had solemnly informed them of the predicament in which they had found the young man the afternoon before.
"It seemed like the best way to tip it over," Geryon answered. "You know, kind of get hold of it from underneath and then roll it, sort of."
"Why didn't you just push against it, close to the top? It would have rolled over if you had done it that way."
"I didn't think of that." "Don't you realize that soft earth won't accept that kind of pressure?" "Well, I do now. But wouldn't pushing on it have just moved me backward?"
"You have to brace yourself," Belgarath explained. "That's part of the whole trick. As much of your will goes to holding yourself immobile as it does to pushing against the object that you are trying to move. Otherwise, all you do is just shove yourself away."
"But I didn't know that. It's the first time I've ever tried to do anything unless it was an emergency. Will you stop that?"
he demanded crossly of Senedra, who had collapsed into gales of laughter as soon as Silk had finished telling them about Geryon's blunder. She laughed even harder now.
"I think that you are going to have to explain a few things to him, Father. He doesn't seem to have even the most rudimentary idea about the way forces react against each other."
She looked at Geryon critically.
"It's lucky you didn't decide to throw it. You might have flung yourself halfway back to Meregor." "I really don't think it's all that funny," Geryon told his friends, who were all grinning openly at him. "Well, it's not as easy as it looks, you know."
He realized that he had just made a fool of himself, and he was not sure if he were more embarrassed or hurt by their amusement.
"Come with me, boy," Belgarath said firmly. "It looks as if we're going to have to start at the very beginning."
"Well, it's not my fault. I didn't know. You should have told me."
"I did not know that you were planning to start experimenting so soon," the old man replied. "Most of us have sense enough to wait for guidance before we start rearranging the local geography."
"Well, at least I did manage to move it," Geryon said defensively, as he followed the old man across the meadow toward the tower.
"Splendid. Did you put it back the way you found it?"
"Why? What difference does it make?"
"We don't move things here in the Vale. Everything that's here is here for a reason, and they are all supposed to be exactly where they are."
"I didn't know,"
Geryon apologized.
"You do now. Let's go put it back where it belongs."
They trudged along in silence.
"Grandfather,"
Geryon said finally.
"Yes?"
"When I moved the rock, it seemed that I was getting the strength to do it from all around me. It seemed just to flow in from every place. Does that mean anything?"
"That's the way it works," Belgarath explained. "When we do something, we take the power to do it from our surroundings. When you burned Kamdar, for example, you drew the heat from all around you, from the air, the ground, from everyone who was in the area. You drew a little heat from everything to build the fire. When you tipped the rock over, you took the force to do it from everything nearby."
"I thought it all came from inside."
"Only when you create things," the old man replied. "That force has to come from within us. For anything else, we borrow. We gather up a little power from here and there and put it all together, and then turn it loose, all at one spot. Nobody's big enough to carry around the kind of force it would take to do even the simplest sort of thing."
"Then that's what happens when somebody tries to unmake something?"
Geryon said intuitively.
"He pulls in all of the force, but then he can't let it go, and it just..."
He spread his hands and jerked them suddenly apart. Belgarath looked narrowly at him.
"You've got a strange sort of mind, boy. You understand the difficult things quite easily. But you can't seem to get hold of the simple ones. There's the rock."
He shook his head.
"Oh, that will never do. Put it back where it belongs, and try not to make so much noise this time. That racket you raised yesterday echoed all over the Vale."
"What do I do?"
"Gather in the force. Take it from everything around.
Geryon tried.
"Not from me!"
the old man exclaimed sharply. Geryon excluded his grandfather from his field of reaching out and pulling in. After a moment or two, he felt as if he were tingling all over, and that his hair was standing on end.
"Now what?"
he asked, clenching his teeth to hold it in.
"Push out behind you, and push at the rock at the same time."
"What do I push at behind me?"
"Everything. And at the rock as well. It has to be simultaneous."
"Won't I get sort of squeezed in between?"
"Tense yourself up."
"We'd better hurry, Grandfather,"
Geryon said.
"I feel like I'm going to fly apart."
"Hold it in. Now, put your will on the rock and say the word."
Geryon put his hands out in front of him and straightened his arms.
"Push!"
he commanded. He felt the surge and the roaring. With a resounding thud, the rock teetered and then rolled back smoothly to where it had been the morning before. Geryon suddenly felt bruised all over, and he sank to his knees in exhaustion.
"Push!" Belgareth said incredulously.
"You said to say push."
"I said to push. I didn't say to say push."
"It went over. What difference does it make what word I used?"
"It's a question of style," the old man said with a pained look. "Push sounds so babyish."
Weakly, Geryon began to laugh.
"After all, Geryon, you do have a certain dignity to maintain," the old man said loftily. "If we go around saying push or flop or things like that, no one's ever going to take us seriously."
Geryon wanted to stop laughing, but he simply couldn't. Belgareth stalked away indignantly, muttering to himself. When they returned to the others, they found that the tents had been struck and the pack horses loaded.
"There's no point in staying here," Aunt Paul told them, "and the others are waiting for us. Did you manage to make him understand anything, Father?"
Belgareth grunted, his face set in an expression of profound disapproval.
"Things did not go well, I take it?"
"I'll explain later," he told her shortly.
During Geryon's absence, Tenedra, with much coaxing and a lapful of apples from their stores, had seduced the little colt into a kind of ecstatic subservience. He followed her about shamelessly, and the rather distant look he gave Geryon showed not the slightest trace of guilt.
"You're going to make him sick," Geryon accused her.
"Apples are good for horses,"
she replied airily.
"Tell her, Hattar."
"They won't hurt him," the hook-nosed man answered. "It is a customary way to gain the trust of a young horse."
Geryon tried to think of another suitable objection, but without success. For some reason, the sight of the little animal nuzzling at Tenedra offended him, though he could not exactly put his finger on why.
"Who are these others, Belgareth?" Silk asked as they rode. "The ones Palgara mentioned."
"My brothers," the old sorcerer replied. "Our masters advised them that we are coming."
"I've heard stories about the Brotherhood of Sorcerers all my life. Are they as remarkable as everyone says?"
"I think you are in for a bit of a disappointment," Aunt Paul told him rather primly. "For the most part, sorcerers tend to be crotchety old men with a wide assortment of bad habits. I grew up amongst them, so I know them all rather well."
She turned her face to the thrush perched on her shoulder, singing adoringly.
"Yes," she said to the bird. "I know."
Geryon pulled closer to his aunt and began to listen very hard to the bird song. At first it was merely noise, pretty but without sense. Then, gradually, he began to pick up scraps of meaning, a bit here, a bit there. The bird was singing of nests and small speckled eggs and sunrises, and the overwhelming joy of flying. Then, as if his ears had suddenly opened, Geryon began to understand. Larks sang of flying and singing. Sparrows chirped of hidden little pockets of seeds. A hawk soaring overhead screamed its lonely song of riding the wind alone, and the fierce joy of the kill. Geryon was awed, as the air around him suddenly came alive with words. Aunt Paul looked at him gravely.
"It's a beginning," she said, without bothering to explain.